The third kind of suffering of love is like dying. It is equivalent to having a festered wound, since the soul is now wholly festered. She lives by dying until love, in killing her, makes her live the life of love, transforming her in love. This death of love is caused in the soul by means of a touch of supreme knowledge of the divinity, the I don't know what, which she says lies behind their stammering. This touch is not continual or prolonged, for if it were, the soul would be loosed from the body. It passes quickly, and she is left dying of love. And she dies the more in growing aware that she does not wholly die of love. This love is called impatient love. Genesis points to it in telling that the longing Rachel had to conceive was so intense that she pleaded with her spouse Jacob, "Give me children, otherwise I will die." Genesis 30:1. And the prophet Job exclaiming, "Who will grant that he who gave me a beginning might destroy me?" Job 6:9. The soul says in this stanza that these rational creatures cause two kinds of suffering of love in her, the sore wound and death. The sore wound because, as she asserts, they relate 1,000 graces of the Beloved in both the mysteries of faith and the wisdom of God, which they teach her, death in that which, as she says, lies behind their stammering, the feeling and the knowledge of the divinity sometimes unveiled in what she hears about God. She says then, "All who are free." She refers here to rational creatures, angels and men, and those who are free, for they alone among all creatures are free to engage in knowing God. This is the significance of the term "are free," which rendered in Latin is "vacant." This verse, as a result, is like saying, all of them are free for God. Some, the angels, are free for God in contemplating and enjoying Him in heaven. Others, men, by loving and desiring Him on earth. Through these rational creatures, the soul acquires a more vivid knowledge of God, sometimes through the consideration of His excellence, which transcends all created things. At other times, through what the rational creatures teach about God. The angels teach us interiorly through secret inspirations. Others teach exteriorly through the truths of Scripture. As a result, she says, "Tell them 1,000 graceful things of you." This line means, "They teach me choice things about your grace and mercy, manifested in both the works of your incarnation and the truths of faith. They forever tell more, because the more they desire to tell, the more your graces they are able to reveal. All wound me more, insofar as angels inspire me, and men teach me about you, they inspire me to love you more. Thus all wound me more with love, and leave me dying of I don't know what behind their stammering." These lines amount to saying, beside the fact that these creatures wound me with 1,000 graceful things they explain about you, there is a certain I don't know what, which one feels is yet to be said. something unknown still to be spoken, and a sublime trace of God, as yet uninvestigated, revealed to the soul, a lofty understanding of God, which cannot be put into words. Hence she calls this something, I don't know what. If what I understand wounds me with love, this which I do not understand completely, yet have sublime experience of, is death to me. Sometimes God favors advanced souls through what they hear, see, and understand, and sometimes, independently of this, with a sublime knowledge by which they receive an understanding or experience of the height and grandeur of God. Their experience of God in this favor is so lofty that they understand clearly that everything remains to be understood. This understanding and experience that the divinity is so immense as to surpass complete understanding is indeed a sublime knowledge. One of the outstanding favors God grants briefly in this life is an understanding and experience of himself so lucid and lofty as to make one know clearly that he cannot be completely understood or experienced. This understanding is somewhat like that of the blessed in heaven. Those who understand God more understand more distinctly the infinitude which remains to be understood, whereas those who see less of him do not realize so clearly what remains to be seen. I do not think anyone who has not had such experience will understand this well. But since the soul experiencing this is aware that what she has so sublimely experienced remains beyond her understanding, she calls it, I don't know what. Since it is not understandable, it is indescribable, although, as I say, one may know what the experience of it is. As a result, she says, the creatures are stammering, for they do not make it completely known. Stammering, a trait we notice in children's speech, means that one is unsuccessful in saying and explaining what one has to say. Stanza 8, Introduction. When God favors the soul by disclosing to it a spiritual knowledge and experience of other creatures, he gives it some illuminations concerning these creatures, in the way that we mentioned, although these illuminations are not always so sublime as the others. It seems these creatures impart to the soul an understanding of the grandeurs of God, which are not entirely understandable, and it is as if they were making these gestures understood, while yet they remain to be understood. Hence it is an I don't know what behind their stammering. The soul continues with her complaint, and in the following stanza speaks to her life, saying, how do you endure, O life, not living where you live, and being brought near death by the arrows you receive from that which you conceive of your beloved? Commentary. Since the soul is aware that she is dying of love, as she has just declared, but that she does not die entirely and thus enjoy love freely, she complains about the duration of life in the body, on account of which the spiritual life is delayed. In this stanza she addresses her own life, stressing the grief it causes her. The meaning of the stanza is as follows: life of my soul, how can you endure in this bodily life? For it is death to you and a privation of that true spiritual life of God. in which through the essence, love, and desire, you live more truly than in the body. And now that this understanding of God's grandeur has not caused you to go out and be freed from the body of this death, Romans 7:24, so as to live and enjoy the life of your God, how can you still live in a body so fragile? Moreover, the wounds of love which you receive from the grandeurs of the Beloved communicated to you are in themselves alone enough to end your life, for all of them leave you wounded with vehement love, and the things that you experience and understand of him are as numerous as the touches and the wounds that you receive of a love that slays. The verse follows, how do you endure, O life, not living where you live? To understand these lines, it should be known that the soul lives where she loves more than in the body she animates. For she does not live in the body, but rather gives life to the body, and lives through love in the objects of her love. Yet besides this life of love, through which the soul that loves God lives in him, her life is radically and naturally centered in God, like that of all created things centered in God. As St. Paul says, in him we live and move and are. Acts 17:28. This was like saying, in God we have our life and our movement and our being. And St. John says that all that was made was life in God. John 1:3-4. Since the soul knows she has her natural life in God by the being she has in him, and her spiritual life through the love by which she loves him, she complains and laments that so fragile a life in the mortal body can achieve so much as to hinder her from the enjoyment of a life so strong, true, and delightful as the one she lives in God through nature and love. The soul lays great stress on this complaint, for she announces here that she suffers from two contraries, natural life in the body and spiritual life in God. They are contraries insofar as the one wars against the other. Romans 7:23. And living both in the body and in God, she necessarily feels great torment, since the one painful life thwarts the other delightful one, so much so that the natural life is like death to her, because through it she is deprived of the spiritual life in which she has all her being and life by nature and all her operations and affections through love. To indicate further the hardship of this fragile life, she says next, and being brought near death by the arrows that you receive, this is like saying, moreover, how can you endure in the body, since the touches of love indicated by the arrows which the Beloved causes in your heart are enough to take away your life? These touches so impregnate the soul and heart with the knowledge and the love of God that she can truthfully say that she conceives, as she does in the following verse, from that which you conceive of your Beloved. That is, from the grandeur, beauty, wisdom, grace, and virtues you understand of him. Stanza 9. Introduction. A stag wounded by a poison arrow neither rests nor remains calm, but searches everywhere for remedies, plunging now into these waters, now into those, and the effect of the poison arrow ever increases in all circumstances and with all remedies taken, until finally it seizes upon the heart and the stag dies. Similarly, the soul touched by the poison arrow of love, as is this soul we are discussing, never stops seeking remedies for her sorrow. Yet she not only fails to find them, but everything she thinks, says, and does brings her greater sorrow. Conscious of this, and knowing that she has no other remedy than to put herself in the hands of the one who wounded her, so that in revealing her, he may slay her now entirely with the force of love, she turns to her bridegroom, who is the cause of all of this, and speaks to him in the following stanza. Why, since you wounded this heart, don't you heal it? And why, since you stole it from me, do you leave it so, and fail to carry off what you have stolen? Commentary. The soul then in this stanza, still complaining of her grief, turns once more to speak with the beloved, for in the impatient love here manifested will endure no idleness and allow no rest to the soul in its affliction, but shows its longing in every way until it discovers a remedy. Aware that she is sorely wounded and alone, without any other remedy or medicine than her beloved, the one who wounded her, she questions him. Why didn't he heal her with the vision of his presence, since he wounded her heart with love, coming from knowledge of himself? She also asks, since he stole her through the love by which he captivated her and carried her away from her own power, why he leaves her thus drawn out of her own power? For the lover does not possess her heart, but has given it to the beloved, and does not truly place her heart in his own, taking it for himself in complete transformation of love and glory. She asks then, why, since you wounded this heart, don't you heal it? Her complaint is not that he wounded her. The more of a loving soul is wounded, the more its love is repaid. But that in sorely wounding her heart, he did not heal her by slaying her completely. The wounds of love are so sweet and delightful that if they do not cause death, they cannot satisfy. Yet they are so delightful that she would want them to wound her surely until they slay her completely. Consequently, she says, why, since you wounded this heart, don't you heal it? This is equivalent to saying, why, since you wounded this heart until it has become sorely wounded, do you not heal it by wholly slaying it with love? Since you caused the sore wound in the sickness of love, may you cause health in the death of love. As a result, the heart wounded with the sorrow of your absence will be healed with the delight and the glory of your sweet presence. And she adds, and why, since you stole it from me, do you leave it so? To steal is to dispossess an owner of what belongs to him and takes possession of it oneself. This is the complaint the soul here sets before the beloved in asking, since he has robbed her heart through love and taken it out of her power and possession, why he left it so, without really taking possession of it, as the thief does with the stolen goods he, in fact, carries off. He who is love He who is in love is said to have his heart stolen or seized by the object of his love. For his heart will go out of self and become fixed on the loved object. Thus his heart or love is not for himself, but for what he loves. Accordingly, the soul can know clearly whether or not she loves God purely. If she loves him, her heart or love will not be set on herself or her own satisfaction and gain, but upon pleasing God and giving him honor and glory. In the measure that she loves herself, that much less she loves God. Whether the heart has been truly stolen by God will be evident in either of the two following signs. If it has longings for God, or if it finds no satisfaction in anything but him, as the soul demonstrates here, the reason is that the heart cannot have peace and rest while not possessing, and yet it is truly in love. It no longer has possession of self or of any other thing. And if it does not possess completely what it loves, it cannot help being weary in proportion to its loss, until it possesses the loved object and is satisfied. Until this possession, the soul is like an empty vessel waiting to be filled, or like a hungry man craving for food, or like a sick person moaning for health, or like one suspended in the air with nothing to lean on. Such is the truly loving heart. The soul experiencing this love exclaims, "Why do you leave it so?" That is, empty, hungry, alone, sorely wounded and sick with love and suspended in the air, and fail to carry off what you have stolen. That is, why do you fail to carry off the heart that you have stolen through love, and why do you fail to fill, satisfy, accompany, and heal it, giving it complete stability and repose in you? The loving soul, however great her conformity to the beloved, cannot cease longing for the wages of her love, for which she serves the beloved. Otherwise there would not be true love, because the payment for love is nothing else. Neither can the soul desire anything else than more love until the perfection of love is reached. Love is paid only with love itself, as the prophet Job brought out when he exclaimed to the same yearning and desire the soul has. Just as the servant desires the shade, and the day laborer waits for the end of his work, so I had empty months, and I counted the nights wearisome of for myself. If I lie down to sleep, I shall say, "When will the day come that I might arise?" Then again I turn to awaiting the evening, and I shall be full of sorrow till the darkness of night. Job 7:2-4. The soul then, enkindled with love of God, yearns for the fulfillment and the perfection of love in order to have therein complete refreshment. As the servant, wearied by the summer heat, longs for the refreshing shade, and the hireling awaits the end of his work, the soul awaits the end of hers.